On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, two wins for Romney. A hot Senate vote on health care and contraception, Syrian rebels in retreat, deadly allies in Afghanistan, and tornadoes tearing through the Midwest. As Republicans battled, President Obama warmed up his campaign message in a speech to United Auto Workers.
I believed in you. I placed my bet on the American worker. And I'll make that bet any day of the week.
Mitt Romney won Michigan, Arizona, talked economy, and tumbled into the contraception debate, not sounding so conservative.
Look, the idea of presidential candidates getting into questions about contraception within a relationship between a man and a woman, a husband and wife, I'm not going there.
And a school shooting in Chardon, Ohio, left three students dead. Here's 911.
We just had a shooting at our school. We need to get out of here. Okay, ma'am.
Got a school shooting. Ma'am, what school?
Chardon High School.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Gergen, Jamie Tarabay of National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Is Romney inevitable again or not? And what do you see in the debate over healthcare, contraception, freedom, women? Are we sliding toward war with Iran? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a great panel with us today. David Gergen joins me in the studio, White House advisor to four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, senior political analyst for CNN, director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School. David Gergen, welcome. Great to have you
here. Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here again.
From Washington, Jamie Tarabay joins us, former Baghdad bureau chief for NPR, now managing editor for White House and National Security and Foreign Affairs at National Journal. Jamie Tarabay, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Jamie.
Hello there, Jack.
It's great to have you all right here. There's a lot to look at this week. Mitt Romney was very happy when the results finally came in, but it was close. 41% for Romney. Santorum close behind, 38%. Here he was on election night in Michigan, said telling supporters a win is a win.
In this room are the people who knocked on the doors and made the calls and went to the polls, and it made an enormous difference. We didn't win by a lot, but we won by enough, and that's all that counts.
Not by a lot, but won by enough, and it's all that counts. But Rick Santorum, by no means, as we head towards Super Tuesday, by no means stepping down, said he considered his second place close finish there a campaign victory.
This was a huge win for us. Let's play it the way it is. Don't give Romney all the spin. We went into his backyard. He spent a fortune, the money he had no intention of spending, and we came out of there with the same number of delegates he does. We are in great shape going into this election. We are excited about what's going to happen on Super Tuesday.
David Gergen, you've watched presidential elections for a long time. This Republican
Too long.
Primary is maybe like a few others. What do you see unfolding here, David?
A mess. We'll see how it all comes out. But I do think that you have to acknowledge that Mitt Romney had a pivotal night on Tuesday night, that had he lost in Michigan, a state where he grew up, that would have been a devastating blow. It would have been a hole below the waterline for his campaign. Mm-hmm. And by winning, he got his caravan out of the ditch, which he needed to do. He blunted the momentum for Rick Santorum. And he's also gone back now to a strategy of divide and conquer, which has worked well for him. The pivotal race is coming up, of course. Most pivotal of all is Ohio. But there we see since Tuesday night, the polls have been closing. Santorum had a lead there, 8 or 9 mm-hmm. points.
Mm-hmm. As he did in Michigan before.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Romney's now gone up in the air in the air wars and with a lot of advertising, and that lead is closing. So it's going to be a horse race in Ohio. But if Romney wins there, it is hard to see. You know, I can still see how Romney can lose, but I can't see how any of these other guys can win.
Meanwhile, you've got George Will in Washington kind of throwing in the towel on the whole White House race. Here we are only in March.
George Will said in his column late this week what many Republicans have been saying in private, and that is they've practically abandoned hopes for winning the White House. Why not focus on the House and Senate? Keep the House, try to make some gains in the Senate, and then you can checkmate President Obama in his second term, and then await 4 years. That was the essence of the Will column. Of course, that is an air of defeatism that Romney and a lot of other people would reject out of hand. And frankly, if you look at the polls, I think it's still winnable for Romney, but there's no question in the last few months, partly because of the nature of the Republican race, partly because the economy is improving, there's no question that Barack Obama has gone from the underdog for November to the favorite.
Jack Beatty, what do you think of George Will throwing in the towel on the White House this early in this year when Republicans have so fervently sought, believed, and desired to win exactly that prize?
Well, you might say that his candidate is out of the race. His wife worked for Rick Perry, and he had to regularly on his Sunday show.
Yep.
And has not been an enthusiast for anybody else in the race, to understate that. You know, what I'm struck with in Michigan is what happened with the president there. You could argue that the winner of the primary in Michigan was the president. A month ago, Michigan, surprisingly, was rated a toss-up just a month ago.
Sure.
Now it's a lean Democrat state with Obama up 18 points over Romney. In other words, a month of the Republican campaigning was enough to do that. And what was the decisive issue? It seemed to be the bailout, or the saving of Detroit, however you want to put it, where Mitt Romney kept really taking a sort of tortured position about bankruptcies and so on that confused everybody, and that the Republican governor, Rick Snyder of Michigan, said, I don't agree with that. I think the president did the right thing. The campaign is hurting Mr. Romney, or at least among independent voters, but it also seems, at least there, also here in New Hampshire, because after the primary here, Mr. Obama is now slightly up. The state now leans Democratic. So there seems to be at least a slight pattern of this. The Republican campaign is enhancing President Obama's chances in swing states.
Hey, Jeremy Tambry, you're there in Washington. What's the music? What's the mood? Is George Will's defeatism on the GOP side of the ledger widespread, or is that to his own pocket of beans?
Well, there has been so much talk about how Mitt Romney was the inevitable candidate, and then you had the anyone but Mitt race, and just the idea that there are still people like Gingrich and Romney, so Ron Paul and Santorum, who insist on remaining in the race till the bitter end. And in that time, Mitt Romney's almost contorting himself into all these different positions. And on the other side of it, you've got President Obama making all these wonderful stops and having all these wonderful speeches. And it was no coincidence that this week he was addressing the UAW on the day of the Michigan primary, saying that guy, the guy who wrote that op-ed saying that you should go bankrupt, he's running for president. So, there's this great big contrast that's going on over here, and it's on one level, I'm sure the Republicans are very disturbed watching it. The rest of us are finding it incredibly interesting and entertaining.
Well, of course, the union would cheer for President Obama. A lot of union jobs saved in that. On the other hand, union membership nationally way down, and a lot of Republicans not ready to applaud on that front. Let's go to our phones. Tom in Pownal, Vermont. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Yeah, I think, Tom, I think you need to go back to Thornton A. Jenkins. He was a United States Navy officer, served during the Mexican-American War. And prior to the Mexican-American War, Jenkins served with the Great Coast Survey. And I just don't think that Romney has that kind of skill in order to beat Rick Perry.
Where are you coming at this from, Tom? A conservative angle? Are you a Republican, a Democrat, independent? Where? Just plain gone. Thornton Jenkins, amen.
He fired before we saw the whites of his eyes.
Right. I think so. I mean, David, here we are. The country has been through a very tough time. Republicans saw a huge opportunity here with President Obama wrestling with a very tough economy. Mitt Romney steps up. He says, I'm the businessman. I'm the guy to do this. What does it say about the country? What does it say about the GOP that it's been such a struggle, David?
Well, let's come back and confirm. The Republicans started out this race with the best chance of unseating an incumbent president since Reagan ran against Carter 32 years ago, and Reagan won that race.
That's a long time.
Yeah, long time ago. But that the everything was in place. The Republicans thought to take it. The quality of this campaign has been two things that I think have really been driving away a lot of independents. One is that how nasty it has been. And ironically, some of that nastiness comes from super PACs, the very creatures that Democrats thought were going to destroy, the Republicans were going to use to destroy Democrats, have been used to destroy other Republicans.
Self-inflicted wounds with all those millions.
Highly negative ads that they poured a lot of money into it. And frankly, we still, you know, Newt Gingrich in a normal election campaign wouldn't still be in the race, but he's got this one financial, you know, sugar daddy.
Mr. Adelson in Vegas.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Rick Santorum is dependent partly on that. Mm-hmm. So the negativity, but I do think the other thing, and I think Jack has put his finger on it, parties hold their races, the Democratic candidates always sort of lean to the left and Republicans lean to the right. In this case, the Republicans are seen leaning so far to the right, pandering so far to the right, to the extreme right of their party, getting themselves into positions that will make it very hard for a Republican to govern on some issues like
that. But maybe that is the party today.
Well, that's the changing nature of the party. There's no question about that. But I think these debates have also given us a steady, relentless show of what is normally done a little bit below the radar screen in the media. Normally, a lot of these smaller races, you know, they go on and you read about it in the local press. The national press covers, but Americans don't pay attention. When you have almost 20 debates on national television and people see it week after week after week, they get a real sense, hey, these guys are pretty far out there. And it stirred up the Republican base, but Romney in the process has dropped 20 points among independents, and that he needs those independents to win.
David Gergen, hold the thought right there. Jamie Terabay in Washington. Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. Listeners, what do you think? Is the primary battle strengthening or weakening the GOP field? And who wins in the contraception fight? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Romney lives, Syria crushing an opposition stronghold, a Senate vote on contraception, health care, more war talk on Iran, and, of course, a school shooting in Ohio. David Gergen is with us, senior political analyst for CNN, advisor to four presidents in the White House over many years. Jamie Terabay is here, former Baghdad bureau chief for NPR, now with National Journal, covering the White House, national security, foreign affairs. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What do you think? Republicans, Super Tuesday voters, what do you see coming? And who wins in this health care contraception fight? Is Republicans, Democrats? Is this about religious freedom, personal freedom, women's rights? Should your health care be decided by your boss's religion? And do you hear the war drums on Iran? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I want to turn to this whole big vote in the Senate yesterday. Mitt Romney helped take us there, I guess, earlier in the week. In an interview on Wednesday, Jim Heath of the Ohio News Network asked Mitt Romney about the Blunt Amendment. This was up for a vote yesterday in the Senate. The amendment, which Rick Santorum vocally supported, would have allowed employers to opt out of providing birth control and other things on moral grounds. Now, here's the exchange.
Blunt Rubio is being debated, I believe, later this week, that deals with banning or allowing employers to ban providing female contraception. Have you taken a position on that? He's said he was for that, and we'll talk about personhood in a second, but he's for that. Have you taken a position on that?
I'm not for the bill, but look, the idea of presidential candidates getting into questions about contraception within a relationship between a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, I'm not going there.
Whoopsie doodle. And the backtracking came very fast. I mean, that sounded straight from the shoulder, but Romney came back and said he didn't understand what he'd been asked about, that he thought it was some local state thing. Here he was later on the same day, called into a Boston WRKO, Howie Carr show, and said this about his stance.
I thought he was talking about some state law that prevented people from getting contraception. So I was simply misunderstood the question, and of course I support the Blunt Amendment.
The Blunt Amendment, which went down yesterday in the Senate, very narrowly. Now, David Gergen, how did you read all that? It sounded like Mitt Romney, I mean, people who've known him for a long time, the line he took there, you know, the government shouldn't be in the middle of a husband and wife's decisions about contraception. But that doesn't play right now when it comes to the Republican base and the Blunt Amendment. What do you see in that back and forth?
I think on this he deserves the benefit of the doubt. He's been pretty consistent on his position about non-interference from what and echoing the conservative line. I think if he had understood what he was, the Blunt Amendment, he would have come out the other way when he was first asked about it. It in this case, you know, I've been on these campaigns and, mm-hmm. and they run awfully fast. And if you're not well briefed by your staff or you don't have time to read the newspapers, you can get caught out pretty darn easily. But that doesn't. So I think this is a minor flap. I think the larger issue, mm-hmm. and Jack could speak well to this, is the degree to which the Republicans have gotten themselves drawn into the social issues, and again, especially on issues of contraception and preventive health measures for women, seem to be very much out of step with the sort of contemporary America. And I understand and I'm sympathetic with the notion of not imposing requirements on the Catholic Church to do things which are contrary to their religious beliefs, and I actually think there's a lot of merit to that position. But on this case, there has been, from the point of view of a lot of women, when they watch mm-hmm. these debates, they're seeing four white guys up there telling them how to live their lives, mm-hmm. and they resent it. And who can blame them for that?
Jack, what do you see in the debate over the Blunt Amendment yesterday? Of course, it went down very narrowly. Three Democrats went with Republicans. Olympia Snow, the now retiring, we learned, Republican senator, moderate from Maine, going with mainly Democrats there. Republicans framing this as an issue of religious freedom and very tough on that. Democrats very tough, saying this is a matter of women's health and women's rights. Who does this work for, Jack?
I think it works for the Democrats, and I think that David's colleague, Alex Castellanos, really spoke to this with, I thought, the quip of the week. He said, Republicans being against sex is not good. Sex is popular. there are positions you can take in politics that simply make no sense in terms of the viability of your party, at least in that election. Now, the polls show 6 in 10 Americans basically support the president's position that employers should be required to cover these matters. But only 4 in 10 Republicans do. So it's a vote for the Republican base. But I think it's indicative that it was Senate Majority Leader Reid who really forced this vote. I mean, the Republicans were talking about it. They wanted to get credit for bringing it up. They wanted it to further their narrative that the Obama administration is out to control people's lives and extend the reach of the federal government. And it sounded as if the Majority Leader Reid just said, well, I'll call your bluff, and you're going to have to vote on this. So I think the vote probably hurt the Republicans. While they're voting on what they called government intrusion, which is that's part of the language that Frank Luntz developed against Obamacare. He tested it. He said, if you want to be against this, be against government intrusion. While they're talking against government intrusion in the Senate, in Virginia, you have Governor McDonald talking. He just beat back government intrusion into women's vaginas with this vagina. You know, that is off.
This now was the sonar.
The ultrasound.
Excuse me.
And now there's going to be forced ultrasound, but not quite so bad. And of course, what's been the result for McDonald? According to the Washington Post and according to people in Virginia, his vice presidential hopes are gone now because he's touched the live wire of this issue. And as David said, that's not where the country is on this issue.
David?
Can I just add one quick thing? But I'd really like to hear Jamie's brother.
Yes, please.
He's personally what I'd be hearing from. I do think the president blundered originally. And Vice President Biden recognized that at the end of this week. He said, we screwed that up. They did by trying to force
Requiring institutions related to
the Catholic Church. And then they corrected. Had they come out in the position where they wound up with a correction, I don't think we'd be having this flap.
I don't know. Republicans seem pretty eager for this flap.
Well, they do, but, you know, I they have a point about the Catholic Church and about religious institutions, but it's a very if they would also come along and acknowledge that women, as part of their health insurance, should have access to contraception, should have access to mammograms, should have access to all of the other kind of things, the advances we've made for women's health. It seems to me they haven't yet given us an understanding that they really care about women's health.
Jamie Tarabay, any number of female Republican senators voting, for the Blunt Amendment. Their position didn't win yesterday, but a lot of women looking here, maybe from the other right. side of the fence politically, or even within the Republican yeah. Party, and saying, "Wait a minute, we thought we had some established rights here when it came to women's health."
Well, I think David hit it on the head. The optics of this debate just really are not very good for the Republicans when you look at it in the frame of, a bunch of white men trying to decide what women should be able to do with their bodies. The optics of that just really don't play well at all. And the Democrats obviously see this as a political winner, which is one of the reasons why Harry Reid decided to sort of force the vote.
Yes, he did.
The sense that we're getting here is that the Republicans, now that this has sort of come to a fore, really don't want to keep the focus on the birth control battle. They don't want to. I mean, and you see this with Mitt Romney trying. He keeps getting dragged into this social conservative debate, which helps Rick Santorum. He wants to keep focusing on the economy. He wants to keep talking about jobs and high gas prices and all these things that he can try to use to get at President Obama. And he keeps getting dragged in. And I think that's indicative of the debate that's going on at the Hill as well.
Let's hear a bit of that back and forth here. This is Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican, Utah, co-sponsor of the Blunt Amendment, which would have allowed employers to opt out of providing health insurance coverage on moral grounds. On the Senate floor yesterday, Hatch said the bill would help protect religious freedom.
Our founding fathers fought a revolution to prevent this type of tyranny. And that's what it is. This is tyranny. It is the political bullying of a religious group in the views of the president's allies, unpopular religious beliefs.
There's Orrin Hatch, but here's Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray telling reporters the 51-48 vote, the defeat of Senator Roy Blount of Missouri's contraception and health care amendment, was an important moment for women and women's health.
Today on the floor of the Senate, we defeated an amendment that would have historically taken away something that women in this country have counted on for decades, and that's the ability to make their own health care choices in the privacy of their homes. I want to thank the many, many women and men across the country who stood up and helped us to fight back this attack on women's health care choices.
Let's hear from our listeners right here. Jeannie, calling from Peabody, Massachusetts. Jeannie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say something on this point, but I was a little disappointed that sort of this huge elephant in the room with this issue is that Viagra is covered by medical insurance, and there is no testing to see if the man is married when he gets Viagra. And the only medical condition that I'm aware of, I could be wrong on this, is having sex.
So pick your point of protest, and they haven't picked Viagra. We take the point, Jeannie. What do you see more broadly?
Well, I also wonder that, so it's far more misogynistic than simply moral values, because if you're concerned about unmarried people having sex, then I don't understand why this issue wouldn't have come up. Well, we cover Viagra, and that's unmarried people having sex, although it's men having sex.
Yeah.
And then you have Rush Limbaugh, who is, calling that girl, wouldn't let the woman testify. First, the Congress wouldn't let the woman testify, the law student. And then Rush Limbaugh was calling her a prostitute. And
saying if she wants the support for her sex life, then she should put her videos on television for us all to watch. Pretty outrageous, weird stuff.
But no one's picking up on the hypocrisy that medical insurance does pay for people to have sex, and that they don't test to see if they're unmarried. And
it takes two to tango. We've got it, Jeannie. We've got it. And let me get one more right there, if I may. Lisa, thank you, Jeannie. Lisa in Concord, Massachusetts. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I've been a lifelong Republican, and I just wanted to say that I think the Republicans have forgotten that Republicans also use birth control, and it's gotten to be absurd. They're calling women who use birth control prostitutes or sluts, and I just don't understand what the Republicans are thinking.
I was thinking
of voting for Romney until he flip-flopped on his position after saying that they should stay out of the decision for couples or people to use birth control, and said, oh, I don't understand. I mean, how could he not have understood that question? It was ridiculous.
Yeah, point taken. Lisa, I appreciate your call. I mean, David, here's the tough nettle the GOP is sitting on.
I just despair about this sometimes because, I think the Republican Party has had a background which they can be proud of about supporting women's rights. And this is the 40th anniversary something called Title IX, which was the bill that was passed that equalized sports in colleges and opened the door to women having a far more active role in sports in colleges. And it's been one woman who's been very involved in that movement told me it's the most important thing that's happened for women's and suffragette movement. And that was passed in 1972 under Richard Nixon, a Republican. And to come this far where it's one thing to be supportive of the Catholic Church, but it's another thing to walk away from women's rights. And you've got to find a way. Politics is about finding ways to meet both of those requirements, not just one or the other.
Well, and it's tough. It's been tough. It's been tough for the GOP lately. I mean, we saw the range of views on all kinds of fronts just in this week. We had the very surprising death at a young age, 43, of the arch-conservative commentator, Andrew Breitbart, a real crusader in the sort of Republican wave lately. His investigations led to the resignation of Anthony Weiner and former U.S. Ag Department official Shirley Sherrod. He was a passionate champion of conservative causes. Here's a little bit of that left, that voice. He died, taking a walk. At midnight, here he is.
This is my war cry for 2012. You need to join me in this war against the institutional left.
And many did join him in the Republican base, absolutely. At the other end of the spectrum, Senator Olympia Snowe, moderate Republican from Maine, announcing this week she would not run for re-election. She said it's just too partisan. It's just too bitter. Here's a CBS News interview on Wednesday where she's slamming the Senate today, these days, for its inability to compromise.
If your motivation is to solve a problem, then you figure out how to do it and what you can agree on. And that's not what is happening here in the Senate. That doesn't mean to say you have to have people in the middle to get it done. You have to have people who are open-minded, who are reasonable, who are practical.
Yeah, Olympia Snowe. But there, Jack Beatty, Olympia Snowe's resigning. Andrew Breitbart, but for his unfortunate demise, would still have been right in the middle of this, not leaving the stage, while Senator Snowe does.
Yeah, that's quite a moment, isn't it? You know, the coverage of Senator Snowe's decision has split the difference, that the parties have polarized because the Democrats have moved so far to the left and the Republicans have moved so far to the right. But the data does not support that. The best polling on this, done by Keith Poole and Howard Rosenthal of NYU in this big statistical study they have done, which looks at all roll call votes since Reconstruction. So they've got this basic computer program. And they find that since 1975, Republicans in the Senate have moved twice as far to the right as Democrats have to the left. And in the House, it's been six times to the right as Democrats have to the House. I mean, to the left. So it's not as if the polarization is equal.
But, Jack, the Republicans might say, so what? It's their right to move wherever they like. And if they've got the voters with them, and they have certainly in the 2010, they had a lot of support from voters. Maybe that's where they are.
That's where they are. All I'm saying is that the way it was reported, it was a sort of 50-50. Mm-hmm. And it makes it hard for us to understand what's going on in the Republican Party.
One corrector here. The Scotch poll data is important. But I had the opportunity, the privilege really, of sitting down with Olympia Snowe a few weeks ago before all this happened. And she was in agony about what's going on in the Senate.
Thinking
and there
about
is no question.
And
her future and how she can make a contribution and how to build a middle and that sort of thing. But there's no question that one of her most severe disappointments was with the Democrats over health care. She thought it would be possible to get a bipartisan bill. That all fell apart. Does she have issues with the Republican Party? Yes, but she had sharp issues with the Democratic Party. So in this particular case, the polarization, I think, is equal, at least equal in her mind. You know, she was having real trouble working with the Democrats on many issues.
Jamie, you're there in Washington. You know how recently and vividly Andrew Breitbart was right out front as a big torchbearer for the GOP. He's gone. But his impulse is still very much alive in the GOP.
Well, it's so indicative in the freshman on the Hill, and this idea that even John Boehner can't get his own team on his side when he goes into these conversations with the president about things like the debt ceiling, deficit talks, and reducing spending and agreeing on budgets, and it's basically the idea that if he cannot even rally his own people, what the way forward isn't clear at all.
Jamie Terraby, please stand by there in Washington. David Gergen, Jack Beatty, we've got much more to look at abroad. Jamie, we're coming onto your turf here. Listeners, you can join us. Have you seen the tanks rolling in Syria? Should we be stopping them? Do you hear the war drums on Iran? What do you say? And what about it with Afghan allies killing U.S. troops after the Quran burning? Should we hang on? Get out? 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, tornadoes in the Midwest killed at least 13. More maybe on the way, we're told. Tammy Risley in hard-hit Harrisburg, Illinois, was there.
It was like a growling. It was the loudest growling that I've ever heard. It was like, it's in the death chill up my spine.
Jan Berenstain, who co-created the children's series The Berenstain Bears with her husband, died this week at 88. Here's a bit from The Berenstain Bears, The Sitter.
Mama, Papa, Mrs. Grizzle is showing us some constellations.
And before that, we played a whole bunch of new games. Mrs. Grizzle says I'm going to be the next Tiddlywinks champ.
Mrs. Grizzle and the Berenstain Bears. And Davy Jones, lead singer of the Monkees, died at 66. Here's their 1967 number one hit, Daydream Believer, Millions Swooned.
Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen?
And that was then. Another war, then plenty of war talk these days. You can join the conversation this hour. David Gergen is with us, Jamie Terraby, and Jack Beatty. What are you thinking on Syria and the crushing of Baba Amr's resistance there to the central government? On war drums on Iran, what should the president say to Israel's Netanyahu when he visits next week? And what about it with Afghan allies killing U.S. troops after the Quran burning there? Should we hang in? Should we get out? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. And Jamie, I want to come first to you on Syria. Shelling and executions continuing there and in homes in other parts of Syria. At least 44 people, we're told, died on Friday alone in northern Idlib province. One Syrian father cursed the attacks for taking the lives of two children. He's interpreted here by Al Jazeera English.
This is the blood of our children. You're targeting our children, Bashar. Are these terrorists? Are they armed? Can you see that, Arab leaders?
They're in Syria. Let's go first to our listeners, Alex in Enterprise, Alabama. Alex, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Alex. You're on. What do you think?
What I think is what's happening in Syria is despicable. It's criminal. We went to war for oil. We can go to war to save lives.
Not doing it at the moment. Jamie Terraby, we have heard some calls to get involved, to create humanitarian corridors and maybe more. But what do you see what's happening there now? I mean, if this pocket of resistance is being bloodily wiped up as we speak, does it just mean the Syrian government now goes one by one and takes down others? Does the international community just stand by?
Well, I think that's definitely the way things are looking in the short term. As we've said now, Baba Amr has basically fallen, and the Syrian police are going in there and rounding up every man over the age of 12. So they're not just rounding up men; they're rounding up boys too. And the thing that we've been talking about with this, this constant, trying to reinforce and explain that Syria is not Libya, the idea that we could round up a NATO force to go in there and provide cover for airstrikes and help arm rebels to take down basically this madman. It is so much more complicated in Syria, and for a thousand reasons. And one of the biggest ones is that we simply, if you compare the situations, and we really shouldn't, but if everyone's talking about Libya, then with Libya you had these people who were identified as leaders. You had major defections from the security forces. You had these transnational council members who were traveling, speaking to the Europeans and to Hillary Clinton, saying, this is who we are, this is what we want. There's nobody like that in Syria coming out. And the takeaway for me from all of this is that the Syrian government is too strong. and no one's ready to walk away yet. And also, you know, just the flip side of it is there, it is such a very, very, very fragile fabric. The breakdown of ethnicities and sex in Syria is so complicated and so layered that we talk about a civil war. It's incredibly likely that something like that would happen. In terms of what the immediate assistance that the West can provide, something like a humanitarian corridor, something like, you know, obviously with Turkey, with the refugees there, North Lebanon, those sorts of things. But as for actual military action, I really think, you know, this poor man who was speaking to Al Jazeera saying, you know, where are the Arabs? And I think that's the question. It's like the Gulf states are rapidly arming the Free Syria Army. And it's really going to have to come from them. If China and Russia refuse to join with everyone else on the UN Security Council to establish some kind of action against Syria, then it must come from the Arab League. And it actually gives it a great deal more legitimacy if they're able to do that.
David Gergen, Jamie, we've seen things in this region in the last year that we have never seen before. We've seen the intervention in Libya. We have heard any number of people in Washington say Assad will fall. It's like destined. But is it? Or is this just the old Syrian formula of roll over, crush, Hama rules, destroy your opponents, and there's just too dangerous a powder keg for the world to come in, even the Arabs?
Look, it's very complicated, but the fact is, when you really get right down to it, it's a massacre. It is a form of genocide. This is what the UN was supposed to stop in the modern age. This is what the United States, working with you know, willing allies, was supposed to be able to, you know, to moderate. I think it's outrageous that we haven't put more pressure on China and Russia and gotten them and shamed them.
Do we have the leverage? We've done a lot of shaming rhetoric.
We haven't. We are letting this thing go on. The world is letting this go on in a way that we can, that should shame us. And there ought to be ways either to provide weapons or provide humanitarian help to end this massacre.
So why isn't that happening? What's the bottom line on why not then? If there's more leverage that we might bring there.
You've got a cynical, war-weary world right now, and Americans have felt that they've carried too much of the burden. The Europeans are not stepping in. The Arabs are not stepping in. But where's the leadership that we should have been able to expect in the 21st century coming from any of these powers? I don't think anybody's handled this very well.
Jack, what do you say? I mean, so many threads tying through here. Should the U.S. really be in there yet again? If it's genocide, how can we not be? What do you see swirling here, Jack?
Well, I thought David's comments were really very well said indeed. I mean, who can not look at this and feel that this is a great crime being committed and we're doing nothing? When you get around to thinking, what can we do, then it gets into all the complexities and so on. I see that, you know, Michael Ignatieff, the Canadian human rights activist, pointed out this week that we really haven't done as much diplomatically as could be done. He calls for what he calls a comprehensive quarantine. No flights from Syria to any airport in the nation.
But doesn't that take Russia and China on board, or are you talking unilateral or
this
NATO alone?
This would be unilateral. He's talking about, you know, no embassies. Shut down their embassies in every country other than China. And now we have the Financial Times saying threaten the Assads with war crimes, crimes against humanity. Now, charge them with that. Now Russia and China will not let that go forward, but they point out that will at least plant in the minds of the people around them, the apparat, that their lives are potentially on the line if the Assads lose. And there was something like that happened in Libya, where Gaddafi was referred to the International Criminal Court, and numbers of his cadres separated from him then because they saw the handwriting on the wall. Now, whether any of this would do anything, I don't know, but it's short of military intervention, and it seems to me it's the least the world could do.
Let's hear from our listeners, Mike in Walpole, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just wanted to say that the grand fact that we keep overlooking is that we don't really go to war anymore. We go to political war. The point being proven by Syria is at war, and what are they doing? They're crushing their opponents. They're putting them down so bad that they can't fight back, or they lose the will to fight back. And we're not willing to do that. We think war is a politically correct type of thing, where when we were, you know, defending the wall in Berlin, these kind of things, snipers, shootings, that happened, but there was no grand uprising after World War II because we crushed our opponents. We put them down. I am not a believer in war. I'm hoping that we can someday find a way to solve these problems. But unless we are willing to do that, use the might that we have, we will never overcome these things. And by virtue of being in NATO, I thought there had to be some sort of at least close agreement on what we thought was right and wrong. So China and Russia not going in with people being killed, how can that be any kind of situation where they should be involved in the peacekeeping of the world if they're willing to turn their heads the other way?
Mike, we've got it. Of course, though, they're right there on the UN Security Council, which is very much engaged with this. Let me get one more view here. Toronto, Canada, Naeem. Naeem, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Actually, I just want to say that in a view, if states wants to get involved in it, they should disarm, first of all, Iran, because Iran is the main culprit in this whole thing, and they initiating since 1980s when they went into in Mecca in Saudi Arabia and tried to take over Mecca. So they're trying to do all the Shiites in the region to make a biggest ever, you know, unrest in Middle East. So this way, the second thing they'll do, you will see, they'll go after Saudi Arabia or Qatar or something like that. So they are actually backing up Syria, and also they are doing all these things in Iraq to go after Sunnis and try to create a religious war, not in a way to create any kind of incentive for any good reasons. So this is the
Naeem, you pulled the curtain back for us in a very helpful way, and I appreciate that, Jamie Terabay. I mean, this really the fabric of this goes right into Iran, and once there, you're into the whole question about Iran, its regional power at this point, its nuclear plans, all these things tied up together. We've got the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu coming next week, and it'll sure to be a lot of talk with him and the President of the United States and the White House about what comes next with Iran. Is there linkage between Syria and the nuclear question and what is done or not done about it, Jamie?
Well, I think one of the complexities about Syria is where it stands regionally, its proximity to Israel, and the fact that Iran has been using it to funnel weapons to Lebanon and vice versa. Clearly, it is in Iran's interest that the Assad regime stays in place, and that's one of the reasons why the Arab League hasn't been sort of so quick to support Assad, and actually has been trying to do the contrary. The issue with Iran, as you said, Bibi Netanyahu is coming to Washington this week, and he's basically coming here to get assurances from the president that there will be guarantees that if they do not want if America does not want Israel to strike Iran, then they want some very clear guarantees from this administration that this administration is going to take decisive action. And I don't know if you've seen it, Jeff Goldberg from The Atlantic had a very long conversation with the president this week all about Iran, and was very, very stridently, as strong as he could be verbally in the lead up to this meeting, the AIPAC coming here, the convention on Monday, just sort of making sure that he has... He's basically trying to say, I'm doing everything I can to make you see that I'm prepared to do everything possible. And the military component...
This is President Obama saying he's not bluffing when he insists that it's unacceptable for Iran to have a nuclear weapon. Hillary Clinton was kind of on the hot seat about that in front of the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Wednesday, and saying, look, we're ready. We're ready to defend Israel against the criticism that it's not doing enough. Here she is.
Not only does the Obama administration strongly support the defense and security of Israel, but we have put more money behind that pledge than has ever been put before. We have a very strong support for Israel's missile defense programs, which are an essential aspect of what Israel needs in these very challenging times. And, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu has called the bilateral security cooperation unprecedented.
Unprecedented. Jack, here comes this big intersection of, we see Syria already. We've been following all the news on Iran's nuclear program. Lots of talk out of Israel about the, maybe the need for a strike there to take it out while the window remains open, but also sounds out of the Pentagon that sound cautious in many aspects. Jack, what do you see coming?
Well, you know, I think we're going to see two men who don't trust each other talking on Monday. I don't know what David thinks about that, but it just seems clear that there's bad feeling between them. And that at some level, Netanyahu does not seem to believe that the president will follow through on his promise, as he puts it in the interview with Jeff Bobro, that he has, quote, Israel's back. That's a dangerous situation. If the Israelis conclude that, in fact, they can't count on him, they might well do they might well strike, and they feel there's an existential reason here, that the Iran threatens their existence. It's you know, if the president, on the other hand, gives them that commitment, on what authority does he give him that commitment? Have we had a debate in this country about war with Iran, what it would mean? Have we heard from the military, who've been leaking for the last couple of weeks, about the consequences to our people in Afghanistan, the consequences in the Persian Gulf, the consequences of a bombing campaign? Just 2 years ago, General Cartwright of the Marines had told Senator Reid in the Armed Services Committee, bombing won't be enough because they will disperse their weapons testing and the rest of it, and we won't be able to find it. And the only way to get at it will be boots on the ground. Now, that's the logic. That's the extreme logic. I mean, we haven't had a debate about that in this country.
No, we have really not. Certainly not in full. David Gergen, you've been in the White House. Do you feel the gears clicking in? I mean, we're just trying to get out of wars in this region. Do you feel gears clicking into place for yet another, with the biggest power yet, Iran? Is that where we're headed?
Talking to people in the administration, there's a clear sense that things are escalating and that we may reach a crisis point here and sooner rather than later. Nobody knows quite when. A couple of things are happening. One is the sanctions are working pretty effectively, and they're putting pressure on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some sense in the administration that from the Iranian point of view, with the sanctions hurting as much as they are and their fear that they're going to lose Assad in Syria and lose their ally, that they may actually accelerate their weapons development. And what I thought was notable, to go back to Jamie's point about this Atlantic interview the president just gave, he seemed to take containment off the table. He seemed to be dismissing, and he seemed to be saying, if they get it, we're going to bomb.
Stay tuned on this front next week. David Gergen, Jamie Terrabay, Jack Beatty, it's great to have all of you with us. Thank you so much. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.